In this labyrinth, the Phantom of the Opera, in Eric's times and ours. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to episode 2 of In This Labyrinth. Thank you all for tuning back in and joining me again. So, I am, of course, your host, Phantom Femme. Phantom as in Phantom of the Opera, and Femme as in the gender location. And I have what I hope will be a really awesome and interesting episode for everyone out there today that I'm really excited to be presenting to you and for you, and that I hope you will enjoy too. I'm going to leave all the housekeeping stuff to the end of the episode because it's a fairly packed episode and there's a lot to cover. So I'm going to save all the housekeeping stuff to the end and just dive right in to what I want to talk about. So for this episode, and actually the next one as well, I want to explore both the original novel of Phantom by Gaston Leroux and the Andrew Lloyd Webber stage musical, and I want to explore how they both relate to the issue of normalcy, particularly through how they both portray the Phantom character. And I was originally going to talk about both versions in this episode, in this second episode, and sort of lay them out side by side. But then I got working on this episode, and I realized how much there was to cover, and I found that if I did that, it was going to be really long. So I decided to split them up. So this episode is going to be part one, in which I'm going to talk about the original novel by Gaston Leroux, and then next episode is going to be part two, in which I'll talk about the Andrew Lloyd Webber stage musical. Yeah, so look for that in more or less 2 weeks' time. And now we can start talking about the novel by Gaston Leroux. So, as many fan listeners out there will know, the story of Phantom of the Opera began life as a novel by French journalist-turned-fiction writer Gaston Leroux, and it was originally published in 1910 in a French newspaper in which it appeared serialized, so one chapter would appear in each issue of the paper, and that was very common for how a lot of popular fiction first appeared at that time. And that paper was called The Gallois. And then, I believe, a single volume, so all chapters bound together in one book, version of the novel appeared the next year in 1911, as did the first English translation of the novel done by Alexander Teixeira de Matos. And a word on that while I'm on the subject of his translation. that the Demodus translation is the one that I will be working from for this episode and for a while yet. I do know, and as many listeners out there may know, there have been other more modern translations done since Demodos did his, particularly in the 1990s, spurred on by the success of the Lloyd Webber stage musical. There have been a bunch of more modern translations done throughout the 90s and 2000s. But for a long time, those more modern translations were not accessible to me because the Demodos translation, having been printed in 1911, has been in the public domain for a long time. It's been reprinted ever since its initial release, and for most of that time, it's been in the public domain. And thus, the Demodos translation is the one that all the e-text and audiobook versions of the LaRue novel are done from. At least all of them, as far as I'm aware. And the e-text and audiobooks are the versions of the LaRue novel that I've been working from. Now, thanks to the wonders of Amazon Kindle and the iBook Reader, newer and more modern translations have now become accessible to me, but for a long time they were not, unless I was willing to laboriously scan them in myself using optical character recognition software and then edit the scanned in e-text versions, which was quite an undertaking because for a long time, let's just say that OCR software was not what it is today. So yeah, for a long time, more modern translations were not accessible to me unless I was willing to put in a shitload of extra work. But now they have become, and so I will definitely be cracking into those. And at some point, I will hopefully discuss them here on the podcast too, talk about how they compare to the Demodos translation. But for now, yeah, the old Demodos translation is the one that I'm working from. And I flag that because, as some fans will know, the Demodos translation is incomplete. It leaves significant passages out. By significant, I mean it leaves large, quite sizable passages out. And it also sanitizes the novel somewhat. The original novel, the original French novel, from what I gather, is somewhat raunchier than Demodos allows when translating for early 20th century English-speaking readers. There's more sexuality, particularly of the Phantom, but also of Christine to some extent, in the original French version of the novel, from what I gather, and Demodos, in translating it into English, filters that stuff out and kind of cleans it up. And I mention all that because the fact of those things getting quite literally lost in translation affects, obviously, my reading and my analysis of the LaRue novel. So I will definitely be revisiting this topic and this analysis in a later episode once I've had the chance to crack into some of the more modern translations and maybe even again at a later date still when hopefully my French comprehension is up to actually tackling the untranslated original novel. To tackling the novel in its original language. Because I will be interested to see, then, if that changes my perception and my analysis of the novel. So, now to talk about the novel itself. As I said, in this episode, I want to explore what the LaRue novel does with and how it relates to the issue, the concept of normal slash normalcy. And it's interesting because the novel never uses those words directly, at least as Damatas translates him. LaRue does not use the words normal or normalcy, any of that, directly in the novel. Even so, though, it seems to me that he has Eric, his phantom, express a strong yearning for normalcy. Again, Eric doesn't use the word normal, but he expresses a strong yearning desire to be, quote, like anybody, quote, or quote, like everybody else, quote, is how Damatas translates the phrases used. And then in the epilogue, LaRue's authorial voice, throughout the novel he has this author character, this sort of detective, investigator, author character that he's created, who does this omniscient narration throughout most of the book. In the epilogue, LaRue has this author's voice character echo and reiterate, with slightly different wording, that desire of Eric's to be, quote, like anybody else, quote. And I'll put the exact quotes, the exact passages I'm referring to, in the show notes for this episode. Wow, second episode, and we have show notes. This is very cool. So, yeah, from that, it seems to me that LaRue is giving his Eric a strong desire for normalcy, both in the sense that it was understood then of being ordinary and average, and in the sense that we understand it now today of fitting in. And this seems to me to be further implied by the way that LaRue describes Eric's home, by the way LaRue describes the house on the lake. Because in both chapter 12, the Apollo's Lyre chapter of the Damatas translation, and in the epilogue, in chapter 26, LaRue emphasizes the ordinariness of Eric's drawing room furniture. Drawing room would be sort of like what we would call a living room today. And yeah, in chapter 26, LaRue, in fact, goes into quite an extended description of Eric's drawing room furniture, and he emphasizes that it is exactly the kind of thing you would find in any ordinary, average, middle-class home above ground, and that the only thing strange or bizarre about it, and in fact the only thing that makes it strange or bizarre, is its being five stories under the Opera House. And Christine gives a similar, though less extended, description in the Apollo's Lyre chapter. And so this suggests to me, and again, I'll put the exact quotes that I'm referring to in the show notes, but this emphasis on the ordinariness of at least some of Eric's furniture in the house on the lake suggests to me that LaRue is having his Eric try to replicate normalcy, trying to replicate a normal, quote-unquote, home for himself as much as possible. And that, plus the quotes referred to before from the final confrontation chapters and the epilogue, suggest to me that LaRue's Eric, that Eric as LaRue portrays him, has a strong desire, a strong yearning for normalcy. But at the same time, LaRue can also be read as being very critical of his society, because he locates Eric's quote-unquote madness, Eric's quote-unquote insanity, in Eric's experience of being shunned and rejected and treated with revulsion and horror and excluded from his society. And that, we kind of take that for granted now because of 100 years of psychology and sociology and social study that show that, yeah, of course, that would happen. But that was not a given in LaRue's time. And in fact, while it was not unheard of, that was actually a somewhat radical thing for an author to do at that time. And indeed, it was more common in American Gothic fiction than in European. And that's something I'll be talking about more, probably around Halloween, where LaRue fits in the tradition of Gothic/horror, both mainstream Gothic/horror fiction, and also in the tradition of using the Gothic horror form for social critique. Because there was that tradition or that stream as well. But as I said, that was more common in American Gothic fiction than in European. So to root Eric's quote-unquote insanity and his criminal behavior socially was a fairly radical thing for a European author to do at that time. It was much more common for popular fiction authors, especially in the Gothic/horror genre, to portray a villain's quote-unquote insanity and or quote-unquote criminality as congenital defects coming from the same cause as whatever made them look physically quote-unquote ugly. And it was very common at that time for villains to be portrayed as physically ugly, physically repulsive, physically quote-unquote deformed, and to have that physical quote-unquote defect, to portray that physical quote-unquote defect as literally the physical analog to or manifestation of their moral and psychological and spiritual quote-unquote degeneracy. And in fact, to portray both the physical and the mental/moral/spiritual quote-unquote degeneracy as congenital, as things that the villain was born with. And then it was very common for authors, and you see this later in horror film, Gothic and otherwise as well, to really set such a villain up as subhuman, as a monster, that the reader/later viewer is really set up to want to see destroyed and killed by the hero. And as feminist scholars and critical race theory scholars, so people who study how racism is constructed and transmitted, and critical disability scholars have pointed out, this way of setting up the villain was a key part of selling the idea of normal as equaling the health of both the individual and the nation and the society. Because at the time when Gaston LaRue was writing and when so much other Gothic fiction and early film was being produced, the idea of normal/normalcy as we know it today was actually fairly new. It's not something that has always been with us. It emerged in the mid and late 19th century as part of the consolidation, the formation and consolidation of the modern industrial nation state as we know it. And it emerged as part of a whole suite of new scientific and academic disciplines and new social practices that were part of the huge, massive changeover from rural, feudal life of previous centuries to modern, industrial, nation-state-based capitalism. And the idea of normal/normalcy borrowed from older ideas, but it put a uniquely modern twist on them. So in older centuries, you would have had ideas of belonging to the family, the kin group, the tribe, the village, the community versus the foreign. And you would have had ideas of the division between the human and the animal and between the human and the monstrous. But these would have been rooted in religious and mythological cosmologies that saw all life, all life forms, as existing in a sort of a cascade of increasing imperfection. It's a notion that derives from the Greek philosopher Plato, and it's usually called the Great Chain of Being. And it sees the world really as descending from the most perfect beings, so God in Christian times or the gods in Greco-Roman times when this idea was first put forward, through the king or the emperor, the nobles, the peasantry, and then down to the animal and plant kingdoms, and most imperfect of all, inanimate matter. So in this worldview, you might have been one of those who belonged to the kin group, tribe, family, village, whatever, but you would have understood yourself as inherently and unchangeably imperfect compared to those above you on the Great Chain of Being. So the nobles, the king, the emperor, and especially to God. But what happens in the 19th century, especially in the 19th century, as the Industrial Revolution is getting underway and really ramping up, because although it started in England in the 18th century, so the 1700s, it didn't really spread to the continent, to the rest of Europe, till later in the 1800s, the 19th century, and particularly till the later part of the 19th century, in places like France and Germany. And as this happens, the idea of the Great Chain of Being gets kind of dropped and replaced with a modern scientific idea that humanity is perfectible, or at least can be improved upon. And it goes along with the emergence of the theory of evolution. The idea that if nature improves upon itself through the process of natural selection, then surely humans, they would have said man back then, who have scientific knowledge can consciously improve upon humanity through scientific knowledge and medicine and technology. And it becomes tied up with this whole strain of utopianism that really becomes strong in the 19th and early 20th century, the desire to use science and technology to create a perfect society. And so what happens is that the old idea of the division between the human and the animal, the human and the monstrous, morphs into the idea of normal as the idea gets applied that science, that new modern science, can measure what is human and what is animal and what is subhuman and can quantify that. And that measurement, that quantification, becomes defined as normal, and it becomes the baseline on which improvement is imagined to be possible. So it becomes sort of the starting point from which 19th century thought imagined that you would keep improving upon until you had created a perfect humankind and a perfect society. And it became the basis for evaluating who was human, who was not, who was a citizen and had all the rights of a citizen, and who was not, etc. And these ideas really caught on and spread across Europe as first England and then later France and Germany and other parts of the continent industrialized and formed into the modern nation states that we know today. And this process brought with it many good things, such as more social mobility than had been available in previous centuries, especially under feudalism, improvements in medicine and in hygiene, so better control of and less spread of communicable diseases. But it also had a dark side, because this new quantified measure, and they actually developed charts and graphs for this, this new quantified measure of what was normal human was based on the Northwest European middle to upper class white male. And so it became the scientific, the quote-unquote scientific, justification for seeing women as inferior, for seeing people from Southern and Eastern Europe as inferior, and of course for seeing people from outside Europe as inferior. It literally became the scientific rationale for defining and in some ways diagnosing them as less than normal and therefore less than human. And that became the justification for all kinds of horrors, in particular those visited on people of color in the colonized countries, in Canada, in the US, in what is now Latin America, and of course in Asia and Africa as well. And where this becomes interesting with regard to the LaRue novel of Phantom is that, of course, this idea of the quantifiably normal human also had effects on people with disabilities and quote-unquote deformities, on people like Eric. Because under older ways of thinking, under older models, someone like Eric might either have been seen as an exotic monster to be feared and driven out of the village, or they might have been seen as part of the poor and someone to be given alms, to be given charity. But their quote-unquote condition would have been understood as basically their place in the great chain of being, as immutable and unchangeable because divinely ordained. But what happens in the 18th century, but it really takes off in the 19th century in a big way, under this new paradigm, this new way of thinking of science, in which normal is the baseline to be improved upon, is the idea that disability and deformity need to be treated, need to be dealt with as part of that project of improving and ultimately perfecting society. And so, on one hand, you get the notion of cure, the notion of curing disease, disability, deformity, and on the other hand, you get the notion of eradicating it. And again, this was a really double-edged sword, because on one hand, it led to improvements in science and medicine that found cures for, or vaccines and other preventions for, many communicable diseases that otherwise caused a lot of suffering, a lot of pain, a lot of death, a lot of disability and deformity. But it too had a dark side. It also had a nasty side, which was that because normal, read, white, affluent, Northwest European male, was understood as the baseline from which society and humanity were to be improved and ultimately perfected, that which fell below or outside of that definition, that measure of normal, was seen as a threat, which had to be quarantined off and kept apart from it. So that's where you get a lot of laws trying to prevent intermarriage between people of different races. And that's also where you get the incarceration of people deemed insane, people with disabilities that couldn't be cured, in asylums, madhouses, prisons, those kind of things that had really deplorable, awful conditions. And that was also used, frankly, as the justification for killing non-white people and also people with disabilities, or people deemed insane, or people deemed quote-unquote feeble-minded. And it wasn't because of fear. In the case of people with disabilities and quote-unquote deformities, it wasn't because of a fear of direct contagion. It wasn't because they were afraid that those people had a disease that could be passed on or anything like that. It was literally a fear that those people would breed either amongst themselves or, worse yet, breed with quote-unquote normal people and thereby drag society, drag humanity down. And so there was a real effort to build walls around normal, quote unquote, normal, read, white European society in order to keep all abnormal people who were seen as subhuman out. And this led to all kinds of atrocities, culminating in the Nazi atrocities of World War II, culminating in, but by no means limited to, the Nazi atrocities of World War II. These kind of, that was an extreme version, but less extreme versions based on similar ideas were practiced all over Europe and North America, Europe and North America, Canada and the US too, all throughout the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And I mention all this because writing in 1910, this is the context in which Gaston Leroux would have been writing the original novel of Phantom of the Opera. And two asides. First of all, I'm basing a lot of the history that I just gave on the work of deaf, that's capital D, deaf scholar Leonard Davis, who's done a lot of research and writing on the history of the evolution of the idea of normal. So sadly, they're not online articles that I can post a link to, but I will put the bibliographic information for the works of his that I'm using as my basis for this in the show notes. And then second of all, yeah, apologies. I probably should have put a content warning at the beginning of this episode. My bad. I know that those ideas that I'm talking about are horrible and sexist and racist, and I hope they're not too triggering for any listeners out there. And I deeply apologize if they are. But as I said, that is the context in which Gaston Leroux was writing the original novel of Phantom of the Opera and creating his character of Eric. And you can see how, in that context, it would have been and was very common for writers and playwrights and later filmmakers in horror genre films to set up their villain as a quote-unquote subhuman, quote-unquote degenerate, and have him eradicated by the hero who represents whole, healthy, normal society, with air quotes around all those words. And what's interesting is how Leroux doesn't do that. As I said, it was not unheard of. There was a stream of gothic horror fiction that used the form for social critique and rooted its villains, quote-unquote, madness in social causes rather than in physical and mental, quote-unquote, degeneracy. But that, interestingly enough, tended to be a thing more in American gothic fiction than in European. And so, in this context, what Leroux does with the character of Eric is fairly radical, because he doesn't set Eric up as a villain. He doesn't set the reader of the novel up to want to see Raoul kill Eric off or see him otherwise destroyed. In fact, Leroux, mostly through the author, omniscient narrator voice character's point of view and through Christine's point of view, really sets the reader up to feel pity and sorrow and even sympathy for Eric. When Raoul asks Christine in chapter 12 of Demadas, the Apollo's Lyre chapter, if she hates Eric, Christine says no, quote, he fills me with horror, but I do not hate him, quote. And later, especially in the epilogue, the author expresses the same point of view. He pities Eric rather than hates him. And in the final confrontation chapters, so basically chapters 20 through 26 of Demadas, the Persian expresses the same kind of feeling, where he feels horror at Eric's quote-unquote ugliness and at his crimes, but he doesn't hate him, he pities him. And that encourages the reader also to pity and feel sorrow for Eric's plight. As an aside, because I'm working from an audiobook, I have chapter references for my quotes and citations rather than exact page references. Sorry about that. So yeah, LaRue sets the reader up to feel pity and sorrow for Eric and to be glad when he is redeemed at the end, rather than to hate Eric and want to see him eradicated and destroyed by Raoul, the sort of hero. And yet, at the same time, as I said earlier, LaRue also has his Eric and has his authorial narrator voice express a strong yearning for normalcy on Eric's part and on Eric's behalf in those quotes that I referred to earlier from the Apollo's Lyre chapter and from the final confrontation chapters. And as I was mentioning earlier in LaRue's descriptions of the Phantom's home, because as I mentioned earlier, much of the Phantom's home, certainly his drawing room, living room as described, seems to portray a desire to replicate normalcy, to replicate a quote-unquote normal bourgeois home as much as possible. And the only spaces in Eric's home that don't do this, that don't try to replicate normalcy, are, of course, the torture chamber, which is not a happy space, and Eric's bedroom, which, the way I read it, is kind of ambivalent, because as Christine describes it in the Apollo's Lyre chapter, and again, I'll put this quote in the show notes, his room is decorated like a death chamber. And in those days, you didn't send your dead relatives out to a funeral home. You had the undertaker come in to your home and decorate up the room that had been theirs as a death chamber, where they'd be laid out in their coffin with flowers and with these special black wall hangings for people to come and pay respects at your home until the funeral and burial. And that's how Christine describes Eric's room, Eric's bedroom, being decorated, as we know, complete with coffin for him to sleep in. The only difference is that, as Christine describes it, instead of white trim being used to lighten the atmosphere just a little bit, Eric has the notes of the Dies Irae repeated on the wall hangings. And for those familiar with the old Latin Roman Catholic Mass, Roman Catholic liturgy, the Dies Irae is a part of the funeral service, part of the Requiem service, that talks about the day of wrath and the day of judgment. Dies Irae literally means day of wrath. And so, to me at least, this space of Eric's room is very ambiguous and ambivalent, because one way to read it is as a defiance of normalcy, him going, well, you've all defined me and see me as a living corpse, so I'm going to embrace that and rock that out. And that reading is somewhat supported by the fact that that space, Eric's bedroom, is also where his pipe organ is and his desk where he composes. So that's the seat, the location of his creative self-expression. But you could also read the space of Eric's room as a self-punishment, because, quote, corpse, unquote, or, quote, built up of death, unquote, is what Eric calls himself later on in that chapter and elsewhere when he's describing himself as repulsive and as unlovable. And so surrounding himself by these funereal decorations could be read as constantly reminding himself of, quote unquote, what he is, and therefore why he can never be, quote, like anybody, unquote, or, quote, like everybody else, unquote, reminding himself of why he can never be normal. And that reading is kind of lent to as well by the presence of the Dies Irae on the wall hangings, because as I said, the Dies Irae is the part of the Requiem service that speaks of the day of wrath and the day of judgment. So it's an allusion to punishment. It's a reference to punishment. And also, even where Eric is trying to replicate bourgeois normalcy for himself, in chapter 26, LaRue has Eric describe all that very ordinary middle-class furniture as, quote, all that I have left of my poor unhappy mother, unquote, is the way Damatas translates it. And as we know from later in chapter 26, from the Apollo's Lyre chapter, and from the epilogue, Eric's mother, and father too, treated him with revulsion and horror. So this very ordinary middle-class bourgeois furniture that he's got in his home may be a replication of normalcy, but it's not associated with happy memories. Indeed, it's a constant reminder of Eric's very first experience of exclusion and shunning. So that, too, lends to a possible reading of it as self-punishment, of reminding himself of, quote-unquote, what he is and why he can't be normal. So with all that, I find myself reading the LaRue novel as being ambivalent about normal/normalcy. Of course, just from the novel itself, and until I've done a great deal more research into LaRue's own life and times and politics, it's impossible to tell what his personal views would have been. And, as I said, I'll be interested to see if reading the more modern translations and someday reading the untranslated novel in the original French alter my reading, alter my interpretation of it. But yeah, as I said, at the moment, I find myself reading the LaRue novel as ambivalent about this idea of normal slash normalcy that had come up so fast and become so dominant in his time. Because on one hand, as I said before, LaRue ascribes Eric's quote-unquote criminal insanity to his experience of being shunned and rejected by society, rather than giving it a biological cause. And he asks us to feel pity and sorrow for Eric instead of setting him up as a menace that has to be eradicated in order to preserve quote-unquote wholesome, quote-unquote respectable society. And I think there's a case to be made for reading those things as a critique, as a criticism on LaRue's part of the way his society treated people it deemed abnormal, at least with regard to people with physical disabilities and deformities. And possibly with regard to people of color, too, because of some of the ways that LaRue portrays the character of the Persian. But I'll go into that in more detail in a future episode, because there's some really interesting stuff there. So yeah, as I said, I think there's a case to be made for reading LaRue as being at least somewhat critical of the way his society treats people it deems abnormal. But on the other hand, as I also mentioned before, he portrays his Eric as yearning for a normalcy that he can never have, and in fact, that's part of how he evokes our pity for Eric. So on one hand, the novel seems to be calling for society to be more accepting of people like Eric, but on the other hand, it almost seems to be saying that if only Eric could have been normal, then he could have been happy and all this tragedy would have been avoided. In the epilogue, the narrator character says, quote, he only asked to be somebody like everybody else, but he was too ugly and had to hide his genius or use it to play tricks with, when, with an ordinary face, he would have been among the most distinguished of mankind. He had a heart that could have held the empire of the world, and in the end, he had to content himself with a cellar. Oh yes, we must needs pity the opera ghost, unquote, is how Damatas translates the passage, and apologies for the mankind sexist term there, but that's how Damatas renders it. But I think that passage, and I'll put that quote in the show notes too, really captures the ambivalence that I'm talking about, because is it lamenting that society isn't more accepting, or is it lamenting that Eric could never be quote-unquote normal because his quote-unquote deformity is too extreme? Or is it doing both? And in some ways, I'm inclined to read both that passage and in some ways the whole novel as in fact doing both. So those are my thoughts so far on the LaRue novel and what it does with the issue of normal/normalcy. And next episode, we'll fast forward 74 odd years to talk about the Andrew Lloyd Webber stage musical and what it does with that. So yeah, stay tuned for that in 2 weeks, more or less. I'm hoping to have that out around the 15th, give or take a day or so. And yeah, that's going to be the regular schedule from here on in, to put an episode out roughly every 2 weeks. So in the meantime, of course, you can tweet at or follow the show at ITL Podcast. And you can also check out the podcast website at http://inthislabyrinth.fireside.fm. And that's where the show notes will be posted for this episode. Though, bear with me, it may take me a day or two or three to get them up. So, if I could ask for your patience on that. But I'll get them up ASAP. You can also like and follow the podcast Facebook page at facebook.com/inthislabyrinth/. And there's a link to the Facebook page on the podcast website. And you can also join the Facebook group for this podcast. As I mentioned in the last episode, I set up a Facebook group as well so that there's a more interactive space available for sharing and discussion. And that's the full title of the show plus tagline. So, In This Labyrinth, The Phantom of the Opera in Eric's Times and Ours. But searching In This Labyrinth on Facebook should bring it up. That should bring up both the Facebook page and the Facebook group. And the Facebook group is linked to on the Facebook page as well. So hopefully both of them are easy to find. And of course, you can send an email to inthislabyrinth@yahoo.com. So feel free to get in touch by any one of those methods. I would love to hear what folks thought of this episode. And of course, I hope everyone will tune back in more or less 2 weeks for part two of this discussion of Phantom and what it does with normal/normalcy when we talk about the Andrew Lloyd Webber stage musical. So stay tuned for that and have a great Phantom-filled 2 weeks in the meantime. Copyright notice with a slight correction from last episode. The intro music and all the podcast audio is copyright to me, Phantom Femme, and the wonderful podcast artwork that you see on the podcast website and the Facebook page and group is copyright Isabeau of WAGProductions.org and is used with her kind and awesome permission. And please do check out her work as well. And anything else, all quotes and articles posted or linked to in the show notes are copyright of their respective owners.